I missed one thing. Democracy, if you don't know history, and I'm quoting David as an author, he's brought our nation's past to life for countless, countless readers. He has so many awards. I was told to, somebody slipped me a note and said, please feel free to exaggerate. Now, if I exaggerate, you'd be here 10 minutes as I run through all the awards, maybe 40 honorary doctorates, but a couple I do want to mention, two Pulitzer Prize awards and recipient of the President's Medal of Freedom. It's the highest civilian honor that we give in the United States. Now, he did not start out as a historian. In fact, I think March Madness is coming. As I recall, his first job was a trainee with Sports Illustrated. Am I close? He says yes. His education with a degree in English at Yale was grounded in his humanities, strong advocate of the liberal arts, education, pointing out that our founding fathers were educated in classics and humanities. What distinguishes this gentleman from all other historians, in our opinion, is he brings us into the world of his subjects. He believes that reading history should be a source of pleasure. And again, I quote, I do feel in my heart of hearts that if history isn't well written, it isn't going to be read. And if it isn't read, it is going to die. And I try to write the kind of book that I would like to read. We've all had the stultifying experience of listening to a history teacher that goes through statistics and statistics and more statistics, and even the most avid student probably falls asleep. But when we look at something like John Adams, the book, and other of McCullough's books, history just springs off the page. They put you in that era, in the life of that person. You're right there. And I think that's what's so different from so many other historic writers. And I want to add another quote. It is clear his books have, and again, quote, led to a renaissance of interest in American history. Now, I'd like to recount one personal thing. This goes back to 1991, 9/11. In Omaha, Nebraska, we happened to be there for the governor's humanitarian lecture, and David McCullough was to be the speaker. We were concerned that maybe he couldn't get there because of what had happened to air transportation. I think someplace in that night in his remarks, he mentioned, you know, I woke up and I thought to myself, I got to get to Omaha. And I think he said to his wife, we're going to go to Omaha. And he was there that night, 9 days after 9/11. And there we sat in that auditorium, about 1,000 people, and watched the President, George W. Bush's address to the nation. And what Ann and I noticed was we saw where David McCullough was seated, and we noted him paying very, very close attention to the President's address, and he had a little pad, and he was making some notes. Okay? Guess what happened? He gets up, and what he does, talking about the event that really changed a lot of things in this nation. And what he did was parallel many of the challenges by John Adams, because that was the book we got that night, and brought that forward to some of the similar perils that President Bush was facing and would face. And it was so interesting at how fast he reacted, how much involved he knew Adams was from that book, and paying attention to that address that night. We were delayed, I don't know how long, at least a half an hour until David got to the podium. But again, a very, very special evening, the way he handled his address. I'm going to finish on one thing, one other quote, if you don't mind. History is a guide to navigation in perilous times. And certainly John Adams had some, and George W. Bush had some. So today we have the author of that sentence himself, and I ask you to give a warm 30th anniversary Forum Club a welcome to David McCullough, our speaker.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave, and thank you all very much. It's a pleasure and an honor to take part in this 30th anniversary event. And I appreciate greatly what you said, Dave, in your opening remarks. And I still hold that we have to understand our story, our history as a country, if we are to continue with the ultimate objectives that our founders have and that we were raised to have ourselves. And we must continue to encourage and stimulate that kind of commitment to history in our among our children and grandchildren. So I say that in part because I want to say how greatly I am impressed by and certainly entirely in harmony with all that this organization does to further education. I don't think there's anything more important that we can do. I think our teachers are the most important people at work in our country today. I think that the improvements that need to be made in education are immense, but they may be accomplished. This is not beyond accomplishment. All it takes is leadership. And the kind of leadership that we need is not just leadership in public office, but leadership in all aspects of life. And one of the things that I feel very strongly is that a knowledge of history is essential to leadership. And many people have said it before me and very eloquently. George C. Marshall, when he was Secretary of State, was asked by reporters at a press conference one day if he had a good education at VMI. He said, "No, I didn't." He said, "Why not, sir?" He said, "We had no history." And so if I can convey some of that fervor that I feel to many of you today, or re-emphasize what you already feel, I will be very pleased to say that I've been among you. One of the clearest lessons of history is that very little of consequence is ever accomplished alone. The expression self-made man, for example, is ridiculous. No such thing. No self-made man or woman. We're all the result of many people who have influenced our lives, have inspired us, or been our rivals. And it's true with accomplishing anything. And I know from my own experience the numbers of people who helped me accomplish the books that I write. The archivists, librarians, specialists in some aspect of scholarship, people I interview, people all over the country, indeed all over the world. And I would not be able to do what I do without their help, without their friendship, without their effort. And of all the people who have helped me the most is my editor-in-chief, who is also my wife, Rosalie, and I wanted to introduce you to her. Now, don't get up yet. Before she stands up, I want to explain. She is mission control in our family. She is Secretary of the Treasury and Chair of the Ethics Committee. And she reads everything that I write aloud to me many times over because I'm often rewriting all the way through. I try to write for the ear as well as the eye. Also, if you have someone read back to you what you've written, you very quickly see or hear that there are things that need to be improved that you might not get by just looking at the page again and again. Rosalie, please stand up. And oh, can she dance? Oh. The Piedmont Driving Club in Atlanta, Georgia gives a big ball every year. And we were invited to come and be the toasts of the evening. And because of Theodore Roosevelt's mother, who figured in so importantly in my book, the mornings on horseback, came from right nearby. And many people feel, and I think there's a good argument for it, she was the basis for Scarlett O'Hara. And her house is still there and so forth. So we arrived at the Piedmont Ball, black tie dinner, and we're told that this Atlanta Symphony was playing that night for the dance. And what an honor that would be. And it was all antebellum costumes and magnolia blossoms, and it was the old South out in full force. And so we were to come down this long flight of stairs and go out on the ballroom floor before anyone and dance around for the first number. And as we were about to descend the stairs, our hostess said, "And by the way, tonight is waltz night. Only going to play waltzes." Well, my heart sank because I can't waltz. So I said to Rosalie, "What am I going to do?" She said, "Follow me." So we got out on the floor, and she's going, "One, two, three, one, two, three." And I can only turn in one direction. So we were just turning in one direction all around the dance floor. And it was great. Worked perfectly. So after a while, there was a break, and Rosalie went down to the ladies' room, and all these southern ladies, "Oh, we're all just so jealous of you to have a husband who can waltz like he can." But it's a perfect metaphor for our whole marriage and my work and everything. Said, "One, two, three, one, two, three." I got stuck in a traffic jam one morning a number of years ago on Massachusetts Avenue in Washington. I was on my way to an appointment, driving myself, and I got stuck right at Sheridan Circle. And I was mad that I was late, and I was mad there was traffic. And I looked over at old Phil Sheridan in the center of the circle. He's up on his horse with a requisite pigeon on his head. And I thought, I wonder how many people who drive around here every morning, twice a day, have any idea who that was. And thought, probably very few. Thousands of people go around and have no idea who that is, or any curiosity but to find out, which made me feel even lower. And then, on my radio, Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue began to play. And it just lifted me right out of my doldrums and out of my hot seat, the driver's seat. And I began to think, who's more important to our story, to our history, to who we are as Americans? Phil Sheridan or George Gershwin? And the answer, of course, is they're both important. But you shouldn't leave Gershwin out. So I determined that I was going to do something to emphasize that history isn't just about politics and war, that history is about life. History is about the human experience and high achievement in many fields. And so what resulted, and possibly out of the thought of Gershwin's Americans in Paris, to do a book about those young Americans with talent and aspiring to do their best, who went to Paris in the 19th century to become physicians or artists or architects or writers and so forth. And what resulted was my book, The Greater Journey. And when I got to the end of that book and writing that book, which I had stopped in 1900, my strong impulse was to keep going on into the 20th century, but to skirt around the sort of cliche 20th century Americans in Paris picture of Hemingway and Gertrude Stein. It's been overdone and it's fake and I don't like it. But and it was amazing to find the numbers of people in a number of fields: engineering, economics, art, music, architecture, on and on, who had come to Paris for the very purpose, as had their predecessors in the 19th century, and who brought back what they had learned and made a mark in the betterment of our society, our country. And much to my surprise, who did I discover was in Paris, in France, and what they did there was of momentous importance, were the Wright brothers. So I began reading about them, and the more I read about them, the more astonished I was at not only how little I knew, but how very much more there was to their story and to them as human beings than most of us have any idea. So I changed my direction. I said, I'm going to make this book about the Wright brothers. And just the week before last, I finished the book. It's all done. It will be published in May, May 5th of this year. And I am very pleased that the publisher and others are very excited about it. Now, most Americans, if you ask them who were the Wright brothers, they'll say they had something to do with the airplane. And what else do you know? Well, I think they made bicycles. Or I think maybe they came from Ohio. I was talking with a very well-educated, sophisticated New York friend who prides herself in being knowledgeable about much of everything. That's right. And she, you got her. And she said, well, what are you working on, David? And I said, I'm working on a book about the Wright brothers. Who? The Wright brothers. Who were they? I said, they invented the airplane. Oh, I thought that was Lindbergh. Now, the Wright brothers were bicycle manufacturers and repairmen. They had a little bicycle shop in Dayton, Ohio. And they were very clever mechanics. And they did invent the airplane. But that's only a fraction of the story. They were also brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I think there's no question that Wilbur Wright, the older of the two, was a genius. They were also uneducated by our formal terms. Neither of them ever finished high school. But we can't pass judgment on that when you stop to realize how much they read and how much they knew and how great was their intellectual curiosity. They grew up in a house in Dayton, now at the Ford, the house is now at the Ford Museum at Dearborn, Michigan, that had no running water, no indoor plumbing, no electricity, no telephone, but was filled with books. And their father, an itinerant preacher, insisted that they not only read, but they read everything and take an interest in everything. And if they had a project that they were working on that he thought was of merit and worth their time, and they preferred to stay home and work on the project rather than going to school, he said, fine. He was an amazing man. And how he raised those two boys and their sister is in itself a lesson to all of us. Because he was an itinerant preacher, he was away much of the time. And because he was away, they were writing him or he was writing them. And this insistence on keeping in touch by mail, which was part of that generation, and for many of us, it was part of how we grew up too, we now have over 1,000 private letters that have survived, written by the two Wright brothers and their sister, Catherine. And they are gold mines of material, not only about what was worrying them or what was causing them to feel satisfaction, what was frustrating them, how they felt about each other, how they felt about their own capacity for work and success, all is out, spelled right out there. And they wrote superbly. They could use the English language in a way that very few of us can today. Again, because of that father and because of his insistence on reading and learning to express themselves both on paper and on their feet. Now, I just gave a talk at the Tuck Business School at Dartmouth, and this is one of the points I stressed. If you wanted to learn about success, read about these two young men, because of their capacity to use the English language. And in today's reality, as many of you know, over half the business schools in the country now are requiring their incoming freshmen, who of course are all college graduates, to take a basic writing course because they are incapable of writing a presentable letter or report or proposal, something that will stand the test on paper. These young men were interested in history, architecture, music. They each played an instrument. One played the mandolin, the other played the harmonica. They loved to sing. They loved poetry. They loved natural history. They read everything. And their father even encouraged them to read the great agnostic Ralph Ingersoll, saying, "You ought to know about this." And they read it, Ingersoll, and they stopped going to church. And the father never, that we can tell, never in any way reprimanded them or act angry or disappointed about them. Wilbur was once asked what were his secrets to success. He said, "Pick out a good mother and father and grow up in Ohio." Now, the Wright brothers started out determined to learn to fly, but they understood that the way we're going to learn to fly would be to fly. Now, Samuel Langley and Octave Chanute and some of the other great engineering aeronautic theorists of the time never, ever went up in the air. Wilbur's explanation for their approach, the Wright brothers' approach, was that if you want to train a wild horse, there are two ways to do it. One is to sit on the fence, study the horse, write down all the things that the horse does wrong, and then write down the ways that you think you could correct that. The other way is to get on the horse and ride it. And he says the second way is the one that works. So not only did they have their theories and build their own gliders first, and then eventually their first motor-driven machine, but they flew them. So it is not just genius or ingenuity or mechanical talent, but courage. Every time they got on the plane to fly or the glider to fly, they were risking their lives. They could be killed. As a consequence, they never flew together because if one got killed, the other one could then still carry on with the mission. And they saw this as a mission. Was as much of a mission as was their father's devotion to his work. They had no money. They knew no one in high places. They had no political contacts. They did it all themselves with the earnings that they made with their bicycle shop. And when at one point Octave Chanute said he knew Andrew Carnegie pretty well and he thought that Andrew Carnegie would be very happy to put up $10,000, which was a fortune then, they said, "No thanks. We're going to do it ourselves." And they did. Samuel Langley, who was the head of the Smithsonian, had his contrivance that he tried to fly down by the Potomac River. And it just crashed in the Potomac River several times. It never really worked. Being flown by somebody, he got to take the risk. And he spent $70,000, primarily the people's money out of the Smithsonian, but also private donations, to no effect. Now, $70,000 doesn't sound like much today. It was a very great deal of money then, unprecedented amount of money. The Wright brothers spent less than $1,000 to fly their plane. Now, one of the misconceptions is that they flew the plane in 1903 at Kitty Hawk, and everybody said they can fly, and we're going to fly, and the age of the air began. Didn't happen that way. What you had to deal with after that was disbelief on the part of people, on the part of everybody. They were looked upon as a couple of cranks, crackpots, nuts. And in Dayton, they set up an experimental testing ground outside of the city. a place called Huffman Prairie. It's part of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base now. Still there, exactly as it was. Reporters from the newspapers in Dayton wouldn't even come out to see what they were accomplishing. And they were flying an airplane. And the plane they flew at Kitty Hawk could only take off and land. Couldn't bank and turn and make a circle or whatever. It wasn't until 1905, 2 years later, that they developed the first practical airplane at Huffman Prairie in Dayton. The U.S. government took no interest, would not send anybody out to take a look at what they were doing. Thank you. It was total denial of what had happened until a delegation from Paris showed up at Dayton, all of them dressed in civilian clothes, all but two military officers from France, who'd heard about what they were doing, were very interested, and came to find out more. And they offered them, you come to France, demonstrate what you can do, and we'll buy your planes. So both these men, who were very devout patriots, didn't want to do that. So they made two, three more efforts for the federal government to please come look or let us come there and show you, no interest whatever. And this was at a time when at last Theodore Roosevelt was president and William Howard Taft was the head of the War Department. Absolutely blind. No intellectual curiosity, let alone a sense of duty of wanting to know what's afoot. In good part because Langley's failure had been such a total embarrassment to the federal government. So finally, the brothers said, all right, we'll go to France. So they went over to France on the 8th of August in 1908, 8th day, 8th month, 8th year, Wilbur Wright flew at Le Mans in France for the first time in front of a large public, in a large press public, and military officers and the rest from all over Europe, and for the first time, the world knew man can fly. And instantly, they were the most famous human beings on Earth. Now, it was a turning point of a kind that we have to stand back and just think, good God. Consider right now, for example, that, well, in 2014, 70 million people flew in and out of O'Hare Airport in Chicago. That right at this moment, there are over 5,000 commercial flights in the air in our country, not counting the military flights, the private flights, 5,000 right now. Until then, there was nothing taking off from the earth except for birds and insects. And the world changed almost immediately. From 1908 to 1914 is only 6 years. 6 years later, the world was at war, and in a war in which the airplane figured prominently. Now, to not have that part of the reality of what we conceive to be history is to stand there with blinders on, much the way the Dayton newspaper people and the officials of Washington did. Think of this. I was born in 1933, as many of you, I think, probably were, or about that time. We could have known Orville Wright as youngsters, as teenagers. He didn't die until 1948. Wilbur, who was unfortunately died of typhoid fever in 1912 at a very young age, which is tragic. But it's just yesterday, practically, as history goes, that this happened. Now, two other things to point out about their story before I stop for today. One is that And I am very happy about how this has worked out in my progress with the book, is that Their sister Catherine was an extraordinary human being whose influence on them was enormous and who is a character right out of a great play. She was opinionated, she was feisty, she was smart as a whip, and they turned to her again and again, and she was always there when they needed her, and often in moments of terrific crisis. And I don't think that what happened would have happened had it not been for her, had she not been part of the combination, part of the menu. And she, too, wrote spectacular letters, and she, too, has an opinion on everything. And so it's really a drama of four people, the father, the sister, and the two brothers. And I emphasize again that their courage can never be underestimated. And it isn't just courage of physical kind, but courage to face ridicule, courage to face people who refuse to take any interest in what you're doing, courage to go to a country where you've never set foot, where you can't speak a word of their language, and very soon have to make decisions and judgment about people that you've never met before, and do it all on your own, having had no preparation for such an experience, and winding up doing it superbly. They gave a great banquet to Wilbur at the Aéreo Club in Paris, which is still the room in which it took place, about like this one, still there. And this young fellow from Dayton, Ohio, no formal education much, who spoke no French, stood up there in his rented white tie and tails and gave a speech that no presidential speechwriter today could have done any better. And he wrote it himself, delivered it himself, and with complete poise, modesty, and self-assurance. And they adored him, the French did, because he was so American. Exactly what he insisted on remaining. And when these brothers became so famous and so respected and eventually wealthy, it didn't change them in the slightest. And their modesty, one of their most admirable qualities, was never eroded by that. They had courage, they had conviction, they had determination, and they would not give up in the face of failure. They knew how to get back up on their feet when they got knocked down and keep on going. They would not quit. And everything that could conceivably have gone wrong for them went wrong. Wilbur was very nearly killed in a crash at Fort Myers in Washington, right across, in Virginia, right across from Washington. The place where he crashed is still there, part of the Army base there. And severely crippled for the rest of his life, though he kept on flying. To me, this is a profoundly American story. And I feel it's a profoundly American story that every American ought to know. And I feel hugely enlarged and nourished by having spent the last 3 years absorbing this story in all of its different ways. The great collection is at the Library of Congress. All their diaries, all their letters, all their business papers, their speeches, their proposals, all of that is in the Library of Congress. So there's no problem of wondering, well, what were they thinking, or what were they doing, or what was the real story? It's all there, totally. And they photographed everything, so the photographic collection is beyond imagining. And they were superb photographers. They got very interested in photography. They were very interested in everything. Wilbur writes letters back to his father describing the great cathedrals of France. Our lessons in observation and appreciation of art as fine as one could find anywhere. And here's this fellow who works in a bicycle shop in Dayton, Ohio, in France for the first time, reacting to all of it because he's read all about it before he got there. The rewards of the work I do are so great, have been so great. I've got lucky at one point after I'd started working in journalism when I just stumbled on some material at the Library of Congress, which started me into writing my book about the Johnstown flood. And the moment I got going, I realized this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And so it was luck. It really was luck. But I think also that that in the process of growing up intellectually or mentally, we have so many good choices that, in particularly in our kind of society, that there really is every opportunity for everybody and to a greater extent than most of us realize. I think that a knowledge of history increases optimism. I really do. There's a tendency among many of my academic friends to be very pessimistic. And there's good reason to succumb or to be seduced by pessimism. Pessimism is drawn from obvious problems, but there have always been problems, always. And yet, somehow or other, we human beings solve them. Somehow or other, we human beings get beyond the problem and move on. And then there are new problems. But that's how we've survived as a species, by solving problems. That's how we will continue to survive, I'm confident. And when you see a group of those young, like those young men today, that ought to help sustain one's optimism about as well as anything could. And so I applaud you again for the support you're giving to education and to opportunity for education, and that you yourselves are still capable of the love of learning.
It is a tribute to David McCullough's writing and information that so many of you know about, that we have many more questions than we could possibly answer. But I will start with a very specific one. Were there any Wright grandchildren?
No, there are. Neither brother ever married. Orville said that it was Wilbur's duty to get married first, he being the oldest. And Wilbur never did. He might have had he lived beyond 1912. And Orville never married. But there are nieces and nephews who are wonderful people who have been immensely helpful to me in my work.
I have two questions that I'll put together, and you can then respond. Many say that American history is being rewritten by the schools today. What is your comment? Also, what is your opinion on public education's dropping cursive writing and how this will affect future historical research?
Well, the cursive writing is a big problem. It isn't just that the high schools have dropped it. Our civilization has dropped it. We use electronic devices now to communicate. And what it will mean for the future is that future historians will have almost nothing to work with. If any of you have any interest in immortality, you might start keeping a diary, keep it every day, and when you get to the point when you think the curtain's about to come down, give it to the Library of Congress, and you'll be immortal because that diary will be the only one in existence. And it'll be quoted by everyone. But is history being rewritten by academics or the way it's taught? No. It's, in many cases, being made more boring. But that's an inadequacy of the teachers. More important is history is no longer required in 80% of all of our colleges and universities. You're not required to take history. And I don't think someone can rightly claim to have an education who graduates from college having had no history. I really feel that.
Are you able to hear me?
I think this decline in the knowledge and interest in history is a form of national amnesia, and it's creeping. It's an epidemic, and it's a very dangerous tendency. But it can be corrected, and there are positive things happening. Some superb films have been made. I like to think, and I do think that, like to say that, I think what Tom Hanks did with John Adams for HBO was fabulous, wonderful, and accurate, and fair, and terrific. I think that the popularity of nonfiction or history writers, biographers today in publishing is due to the fact that there's a hunger for it, and that's encouraging. There's no trick to teaching history or getting people interested in history. Just tell the story. Tell the story. Because the story is extremely interesting and often far more amazing than fiction. Imagine if somebody wrote a novel in which Thomas Jefferson and John Adams died on the same day and it was the 4th of July. The editor would say, come on, nobody's going to ever believe that. That doesn't happen in real life.
Are you able to hear me in the back? Here's another one. How important were Harry and Bess Truman's letters to their history? This is asked by someone who met you at the Truman Library at one point.
Well, again, it's the same idea. The treasure trove of letters of Truman and Bess, but much more Truman, most of Bess's letters did not survive, is what enables a writer, or in my case, my biography, to do what I did. And this is true of a great many people, and not by any means have these marvelous collections been all exhausted. There's a lot still out there. And I tell students, the opportunities are as great now as ever, because we're moving into fields like medicine, say, that historians didn't work much in before. When I did a chapter in my book on Americans in Paris, The Greater Journey, on the young medical students who went to Paris, and the material that was available just in the Harvard Medical School library is just breathtaking and vivid and historically important. And so I think one sign of hope is, I think that when future historians start writing about our time, what's going to be the major element on the horizon, on the landscape, is medicine. When you think of what's happened in our lifetime in medicine, it's phenomenal, absolutely, totally phenomenal, and history changing. And more is to come, as many of you here know. Big things are coming, and exciting things are coming, and almost beyond imagining are very close at hand.
Unfortunately, we have time for just two more questions, or maybe two and a half. If someone who never read any of your works before, had never read any of your works before, what would be your recommendation as to which book they should read?
The Wright Brothers. I got to interrupt you one time. I was doing something similar to this at a university in California where they had written questions. And one of the questions which had been written down, the man who was playing the part that Peter is playing put aside, and we didn't use it. So afterward, I looked to see what the question was. It said, aside from Truman and John Adams, how many other presidents have you interviewed?
Ha, ha, ha.
I guess I could have said contrary to appearances, yeah.
Well, that rules out the next question. Have you ever thought about writing a book about Pittsburgh in any way?
There's scarcely a day I don't think about writing a book about Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh is a fantastic story in so many ways. And it's growing up there, as some of you who are here know, it's your childhood is filled with stories. The stories that I heard at the dinner table every night when my father or grandmother got going. The stories we heard in school, the drama of it all. And of course, the great mix of nationalities and people of different aspirations and it's just a story. Well, river cities, river towns are story towns, inevitably. And Pittsburgh certainly is a big story and an important story. But the question is, which part of it? And I'm not saying I won't do it, but there's some interest in making a documentary series about it, and I may do that, but I've got to calm myself for a few days. Yeah.
Last question. Some of you probably noticed how much David appreciated the Alley Cats and the songs and their harmony. So, and I happen to know that David loves to sing and is a closet whiffenpoop, perhaps. But we have a mutual friend who was a whiffenpoop. The question is, are the Alley Cats related to the whiffenpoops?
No, I don't know.
I don't think so.
I'd like to just tell you one quick story that happened just a few days ago. We live in Boston, and we've been snowed in, as everybody knows. It's been terrible. And when there were a few breaks, we'd get to the market to get provisions to survive the next blizzard. And I went over to the Shaw's Star Market in Boston, in our neighborhood, a great big supermarket. And I had a list that Rosalie and I had put together of what I wanted. And I had found everything but cashews. We both love cashews. And I couldn't find them. And I saw this fellow coming by with a Shaw's Star Market shirt on. I said, "Excuse me, could you tell me, please, where the cashews are?" He said, "Yes, sir, follow me." We went over and said, "Here it is." And I said, "Thank you very much." And about 15 minutes later, I was checking out at the cash register, and the same man came up to me, and he said, "Do you do a lot of voiceovers in television?" And I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "Were you the narrator of the Civil War?" And I said, yes, I was. He said, "Well, I want to tell you, back when that first came on the air, I was really suffering from insomnia. And every time I heard your voice, it put me right out."
Thank you.
That was marvelous, David. We very much appreciate your being here. And here's a book I hope that will remind you of
Thank you, an Tom, enjoyable, very much.
Enjoyable situation.
Thank you very much. Thank you all very, very much.